You know, she and I don't agree on a lot.
Yes, it's very strange. Doesn't make any sense.
That has been the theme of a lot of health policy in this new administration. Not only the nomination of Dr. Casey Means, but also every episode that we've done. Doesn't make very much sense. Rolling
forward, Dr. Sister Science Facts. All right, so let's get started. Welcome back.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
And this is Rolling Forward,
where we try to demystify health news and science for you. And there's no end.
We're two practicing physicians with active medical licenses.
I guess that's important to say now.
In multiple states.
Yes, that's right.
We have multiple active medical licenses. And we also are physician researchers with some NIH funding.
And today we're going to tackle the Surgeon General.
We're going to talk about what is the Surgeon General, what is that role, what have previous Surgeon Generals done in the past, and we're going to talk about the new appointee, Casey Means. We'll talk about what her defined goals are for the administration and what are some concerns that have come from both political parties about her appointment.
This is going to be a lot, so let's get ready. Let's start at the top. Alicia, what is the Surgeon General?
So the Surgeon General is the Chief Public Health Officer of the United States. They're also known as the nation's doctor. Unlike Dr. Oz, this actually is the nation's doctor.
But they're not surgeons. They don't need to be surgeons. We've had Surgeon Generals who are anesthesiologists, who are family medicine doctors, who are trained in internal medicine. So even though it's Surgeon General, this position isn't about surgery. It's about being the chief medical doctor in America.
The Surgeon General is also the leading voice for public health in the nation. One of their roles is to communicate good scientific information.
So thinking about the role of Surgeon General in the United States, we thought that it would be helpful to give some concrete examples of what past Surgeon Generals have done to understand what role this person is going to play in the current administration.
It started back in the 1800s, but we're just going to highlight a few you might have heard of before.
The first Surgeon General I wanted to talk about is Dr. Luther Terry, Surgeon General from 1961 to 1965. So that was under Presidents Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson. One really notable achievement of Dr. Terry was that he published the first United States government report linking smoking to lung cancer. At that time, over 40% of Americans smoked daily, and to put out a report saying that smoking caused lung cancer was a big deal, and it led to some major changes.
I'm going to assume it was deeply unpopular at the time.
It was pretty unpopular, including among physicians, many of whom smoked. But it led to some real changes. So starting the year after that, Congress required cigarette packages to have health warnings on them. And then in 1970, cigarette advertising on television and radio was also banned by Congress. So although this was an unpopular report, it led to some real changes. And now we're at a time where smoking rates are just around 10%. So there's been a big decrease, not just because of this, but this was the start of that movement towards decreasing smoking.
Another Surgeon General to talk about, and if there's only one Surgeon General you've ever heard of, it's probably Dr. Everett Koop. He was Surgeon General in the 1980s, and he is responsible for a lot of different public health campaigns, including in 1986, publishing a pamphlet that called for condoms to help prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS during this time period where HIV/AIDS was a taboo topic.
That's right. I mean, in the United States, they initially called HIV/AIDS GRID, gay-related infectious disease. And there was so much stigma and so much general misinformation and fear. A number of children who were diagnosed with HIV/AIDS during the 1980s were children who had received blood transfusions. And then they were in these positions where they were shunned from schools, not allowed to participate in field trips. And so seeing all this misinformation and fear, Dr. Koop, in his position as Surgeon General, thought it was really important to provide factual information. And he sent an AIDS education brochure to every family in America. Over 100 million pamphlets were sent out.
That's amazing. I actually didn't know that.
And in this, you know, he talked about how condoms could help prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS.
What's particularly notable about Dr. Everett Koop is that he's known for being a rather conservative Christian, and he put aside his own personal beliefs and he put aside the political pressure from the party in the White House to advocate for what was best for the public at the time.
That's right. And the administration at the time was the Reagan administration. And you can imagine how they felt that every household in America got a pamphlet speaking about condom use. This was not popular.
Again, we're seeing a trend here about deeply unpopular things that surgeon generals are doing for the benefit of the public, regardless of their political views, regardless of the political party at the time.
And regardless of their personal views at the time, that they're focusing on the evidence and following that. And more recently, the surgeon general under the Biden administration, Dr. Vivek Murthy, who was surgeon general from 2021 to 2025.
Vivek Murthy actually is a particularly interesting case because he was initially nominated to be the Surgeon General from 2014 to 2017 under Barack Obama, was dismissed by President Trump, and then was re-nominated by President Biden. So he had a split term.
And during his most recent term as Surgeon General, he took on gun violence. And the reason that he chose to focus on this is that gun violence has become the leading cause of death among children. Over 50% of U.S. adults or their families have experienced a firearm-related incident. And over 50% say that they worry about their loved ones becoming a victim of gun violence. And so in June 2024, Dr. Murthy framed gun violence in America as a public health issue and called for more research and government intervention around this topic.
Previously, there has been a lot of political interference about even conducting research on gun violence. And so this was a really big and, again, deeply unpopular position for him to take.
And it's been less than a year since that call came out and he's no longer Surgeon General. It is going to take time to see impact, but I definitely am seeing shifts in around how research around gun violence is happening and increases in funding in this area. Or at least we were until some of the more recent medical research changes, but I have certainly seen the impact of this, including a current research call around violence, which is due next week, and I'm preparing a proposal to put in there to do a large project thinking about violence. So with this background of recent surgeon generals and their achievements, now it's time to talk about the current nominee for surgeon general. And drumroll, Alicia, who is the current nominee for surgeon general?
This is actually the second nominee in this administration because the first nominee's nomination was withdrawn.
Nominees' nominations withdrawn. They're appointed by the president and then they have to be confirmed by the Senate.
So Casey Means is now the second nominee.
I had not heard of Casey Means before, so I would love for you to tell me more about her.
I was also not familiar with Casey Means, and I'm going to assume that most people have not been because she has not been a very prominent public health figure.
But if you've been on the TikTok, she's a little bit of an influencer, so you may know her.
The main things that are hurting our mitochondria are the way we're living over the past 50 to 75 years. I think no matter what political side of the spectrum you are on, everyone can agree that we want maximal human thriving in our country and in our world.
Exciting announcement. Good Energy is out in the UK today, and in honor of that, I'm making myself a full English breakfast, Good Energy style.
But that's a little bit of a spoiler. Let's get into her background first.
So she graduated with honors from Stanford in undergrad with a bachelor's in biology. She stays at Stanford for medical school and graduates in 2014. After medical school, she enrolls in residency in otolaryngology, which is also known as ear, nose, and throat surgery. It's a very specialized form of surgery. It's a very competitive residency, and she enrolls at Oregon Health and Science University, OHSU. It's a five-year training program, and she ends up dropping out with less than a year left of her program.
And according to her LinkedIn profile, she says that she left residency in the final year in order to focus on the real root causes of why Americans are so sick. And I just want to take a moment to reflect on dropping out of residency. So residency is long and hard. This is a person who did 4 years of undergrad, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency. So she's 12 years into a 13-year training program and drops out. It's pretty unusual to drop out of residency. Studies have shown that less than 1% of people specifically drop out of ENT residency. It's true that women are more likely to drop out of residency than men, citing health and family reasons. But overall, this is pretty unusual.
It's also particularly unusual to drop out when you are so close to graduation. Even when people decide that they don't want to practice clinical medicine, completing your residency degree opens a lot of doors. And being so close to the end usually is not recommended by many advisors, mentors. They're like, suck it up for the last 6 months.
And just get that degree, get that diploma, and then move on. Because once you have that, once you're board eligible, there's just more that you're able to do than if you have parts of a residency. Because 80% of a residency doesn't really get you much more than 20% of a residency. After dropping out of residency, she starts a functional medicine practice in Oregon.
The idea of functional medicine is that it's a personalized approach to healthcare. It aims to identify and address root causes of disease rather than treating symptoms. And it focuses on holistic care, emphasizing the interconnectedness of the body's system and roles of lifestyle factor in your overall health.
And there is some evidence that functional medicine can help people make lifestyle improvements. And at the same time, many of the interventions recommended by functional medicine doctors aren't necessarily evidence-based.
The kind of main criticisms of functional medicine has been the lack of peer-reviewed scientific evidence, the over-reliance on nutritional supplements, the expense. This like personalized, individualized medicine can be hugely expensive. Most functional medicine practitioners don't accept insurance, meaning that patients have to pay out of pocket. They also involve extensive lab tests that can be very expensive and can be unnecessary and could lead to overdiagnoses and unnecessary treatments, false positives, and that there really just isn't standardization or regularization. So overall, all physicians, all people in healthcare agree that treating the root cause rather than the symptoms is the ideal path for health.
But like you're saying, a lot of these practices are recommending very expensive blood work, very expensive supplements, aren't taking insurance, and are providing advice that isn't based on evidence. And so there's some concerns around some of these practices. Although, as I said, some places have tried to study and standardize functional medicine, and there may be some improvements associated with it. That's different than what's necessarily happening in the community.
So Casey Means starts her functional medicine practice in Portland, and she gets involved in a number of companies. She is the co-founder and chief medical officer of Levels, which is a company that focuses on glucose monitoring. She goes on social media and sells a lot of dietary supplements, teas, and products. A lot like Dr. Oz is touting these amazing benefits of certain dietary supplements without really having the evidence behind it.
And she was a close advisor to RFK Jr.'s 2024 presidential campaign and helped dialogue between him and Trump moving forward.
And right around that time, she publishes a book with her brother, and this is probably what she's most notable for. They publish a book called Good Energy: The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health.
So in this book, they talk about bad energy. So I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but this idea that bad energy is caused by improper lifestyles and is causing all kinds of health issues for you.
They're really focused on the mitochondria, which is part of a cell, and that mitochondrial dysfunction is caused by bad energy, and it leads to all sorts of things like type 2 diabetes,
bad energy,
Alzheimer's disease,
bad energy,
cancer,
bad energy,
acne,
bad energy,
all from your bad energy affecting your mitochondria.
And then this book also says that mental health conditions, things like depression and schizophrenia, can be diagnosed just by looking at somebody's gut bacteria. And certainly there's some evidence about a mind-gut connection, but the idea that you're going to look at someone's gut bacteria and say that they have schizophrenia, that is not rooted in evidence.
As a psychiatrist?
As a psychiatrist and an expert in schizophrenia.
Overall, the book makes a lot of arguments that are not supported by scientific evidence and has drawn concerns from physicians across the nation. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure that energy and astrology signs and like woo-woo is how I'm going to treat my patients.
And the teas that she's selling on her social media, yeah, that's not the direction that I envision my medical practice going.
Let's try to focus on good energy.
Yes. I mean, I also am an expert in cognitive behavioral therapy, where it's the idea that your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are connected. And I think that that is true. But that's very different than saying bad energy is causing your mitochondria to do all these things. And if you just have some good energy, you know, I'm more rooted in the world of evidence, data, studies, looking at the hard outcomes, not the energy fields.
And kind of pulling all this together, her idea of medicine, her idea of health is really focused on continuous glucose monitoring, which she owns a company for, frequent labs checks, which she's an investor and advisor for a company for, and like biohacking, which is this idea of like using science, technology, and lifestyle changes to optimize your biological and physical performance. But she has a lot of financial incentives in what she's putting forward.
So she's coming in from this background, now nominated for Surgeon General, and she's got a number of health goals that she's put out there.
On her personal website, she has a newsletter that she posted earlier this week, and it's titled My Health Wish List for the Next Administration.
And while there are 15 of these stated goals, we're going to focus on the ones that we think are most critical.
The first one on her list is to, quote, remove conflicts of interest and industry influence in the National School Lunch Program and to serve children nutritious, real foods in school.
Oh my gosh, this sounds so familiar.
It's almost like a previous first lady's tackled this entire issue and got out so much pushback.
Who could that be? So about 15 years ago, Michelle Obama really did a lot of work on this, championing improvements to school lunches as part of her Let's Move initiative. And the idea was to address childhood obesity by making school lunches healthier. And there was so much pushback on this.
There was a lot of pushback and political opposition to the Let's Move initiative, coming not only from the food industry, which strongly opposed the call for healthier school lunches. They were concerned about the new nutritional standards and how that would affect cost. There was also a lot of political opposition. Some conservative lawmakers were criticizing the initiative as an example of government overreach. And they argued that it was not the role of the government to dictate what children eat, particularly in schools. Michelle Bachmann, for example, called it a, quote, nanny state approach to health. Remember when Bachmann was like the biggest of our concerns?
I do remember that. I am nostalgic for those days. So it's important to say that this initiative really did lead to changes in school lunches. And there was a study published in JAMA, which is a large medical journal, that compared meals of students in lunch programs before Michelle Obama's initiative and after, and found that the quality of food did improve with larger consumption of fruits, vegetables, dairies, and whole grains, and a reduction in salt and refined grains.
I think it's great that Casey Means wants to continue tackling this issue. I think it's important to have healthy, nutritious foods. And I think everybody wants their children to eat healthy, nutritious foods.
Absolutely. And we'll be keeping tuned to see what happens with school lunch program. But overall, kids should have access to healthy school lunches. So another goal of hers for this administration is to limit pharmaceutical companies advertising to consumers on television.
I feel like every advertisement right now is someone walking up a hill very slowly, and then there's some medicine that comes, and then the whole screen gets brighter, the sun is out, and they're running with a dog, being like, this is the new treatment.
And then they tell you about some drug and why it's amazing and why you need it. And then patients come in saying, hey, I saw this commercial and I need this drug for this condition that they don't have.
Interestingly, the U.S. is one of only two countries that allows direct pharmaceutical advertisements to consumers. It is the U.S. and New Zealand.
And eliminating this advertising, I think, is fine. I think many physicians support it because patients come in saying that they want this new drug for a condition that they don't have and they must have it. And that messaging direct to consumers can have some problems with it.
I think overall, this is a move that would put us in line with healthcare in most other countries in the world.
It'll be interesting to see if these same policies, these same limits on advertising are going to be applied to the nutritional supplements and other products, the teas, the creams that Casey Means has advertised. Because if their plan is to eliminate advertising only by pharmaceutical companies and then increase advertising of these non-evidence-based supplements, that would be quite interesting. So we'll just have to see what their plan is there.
With both Dr. Oz and potentially Dr. Means, really fascinating to see where this is going to go.
I can just see a shift in what's happening, that instead of patients coming in and asking for newer medications that are covered by insurance that they don't need, they're going to be asking for supplements that are very expensive, not covered by insurance, and that they don't need as well.
And also not tested or not evidence-based.
Another initiative of hers, which is to increase patients' choice with HSAs or health savings accounts.
A health savings account is a type of savings account designed to help individuals save money for medical expenses.
And we have an episode about this early on. So if you have questions about it, you can listen to that episode and we go into detail on how this works and how you would save money. Essentially, Casey Means says that she wants to increase patients' choice, people's ability to use their HSA for healthcare related expenses.
This is particularly interesting given her history with HSAs.
That's right.
She's highly involved with her brother's company called True Med.
I started a company and it writes letters of medical necessity, doctor's notes for food and exercise.
I never, ever learned in medical school or residency that I could write a prescription for food or exercise. It's totally legal. And if you do that, it can be covered by, you can use tax advantage dollars tax free.
So never learned that in
9 years.
Yeah. Our company, True Med, this year we'll do 500,000 gym membership recommendations from providers.
True Med is a company that gives you a letter saying that whatever it is that you're trying to buy, it's for a healthcare related expense so that you can use your HSA money on it. If you're going to buy the HSA refunded product through True Med, it's free. If you're asking for a letter to bring it somewhere else to buy from someone else, then there's a fee, usually around $30, but it just depends.
People have been using TrueMed in order to purchase things like Zwift, Pelotons, other expensive gym equipment through their savings account.
And it's interesting when you go online and start looking this up, because some people are pretty unhappy with TrueMed service. People say that they pay TrueMed for this letter, they get it, then they buy something expensive, like maybe some Barry's boot camp classes, and then they're HSA application, their HSA refund request is denied. And somebody online posted their denial letter, and here is what that denial says. After an internal review, we are no longer accepting letters of medical necessity from TrueMed.com.
Juicy.
This letter goes on to say, this reasoning is based on TrueMed's own terms and conditions, that the letter that they provide constitutes general health guidance based on published medical and scientific literature, and it does not constitute the practice of medicine or another licensed profession, and it does not create a patient-provider relationship or establish a duty of care, which is what is needed in order to have a letter of medical necessity.
And there are all sorts of reports like this online, some saying that a letter of medical necessity is required from a licensed medical practitioner that includes a specific medical diagnosis and recommended treatment, that prevention is not a medical condition, and that TrueMed does not provide the appropriate letter of medical necessity.
And this led the IRS to put out an announcement in March of 2024. It's an IRS alert that says, beware of companies misrepresenting nutrition, wellness, and general health expenses as medical care for FSAs, HSAs, and these other types of accounts. Now, this letter does not comment specifically on TrueMed, but occurred at a time that there was a lot of online talk about TrueMed, and it provides guidance on what is and isn't an appropriate expense to submit to your FSA or HSA. TrueMed, of course, has more to say about that, and they provide more guidance to people on how to get a denied reimbursement claim approved by uploading it in a different way or using different language. And sometimes people have success with that. But this is an ongoing issue that TrueMed has been a part of. So the idea that Casey Means suggests that she's going to increase patient choice with HSA, that might sound good because we always want patient choice. But it introduces, again, some element of a conflict of interest where her brother's company has been the source of some controversy, and that in this position, she could try to change the rules and influence policy.
I think it's particularly interesting as at least two, if not more, of her health goals include removing conflicts of interest.
But they're conflicts of interest that are yours, not hers.
This is sounding so familiar to Dr. Oz.
Absolutely. There are so many conflicts of interest in these healthcare choices where people are receiving money from Medicare Advantage groups, from nutritional supplements, from non-evidence-based products, and they're selling and making money from them directly and indirectly, and then at the same time calling out conflicts of interest from pharma, because those conflicts of interest are bad, but these are products that I believe in. Therefore, these conflicts of interest are good.
The last health goal we wanted to talk about today is her goal about vaccines. She wants the administration to, quote, reform the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 and increase unbiased research on the safety of cumulative effects of vaccines on the CDC vaccine schedule.
This concerns me because by including the language, they want to increase unbiased research on the safety of vaccines. I think what they're trying to do is say that people who have done research, it's not valid because they're biased. They have biases of believing in medicine, of believing in evidence, of following the data, and that makes them biased. And I'm someone who's willing to be unorthodox, drop out of residency, tout these medical products that have no evidence. And that therefore makes me an expert and better to know what's true than someone who has gone through medical training and done rigorous externally funded research.
I find it so fascinating that there is this focus on increasing unbiased research and that we need better evidence. And yet a lot of the things that RFK Jr., Dr. Oz, Casey Means support have literally no scientific evidence. And that's okay. But the things that we have evidence for, it's not good evidence. It's not the right evidence. It's not the evidence that they want.
And in order to do research, you go through multiple rounds of vetting of your conflicts of interest, of the validity of your aims. Every study that I do needs ethics board approval. And to the ethics board, I have to disclose any conflicts that I have. And the ethics board has to mediate those. That's really different than how they're doing their research online or doing their research with their patients without having that level of scrutiny or external oversight. So I think it's really unfair to say that the research we have is biased just because they don't agree with it.
I'm also really concerned about what she's saying about the childhood vaccine schedule, where she's saying that the CDC recommended schedule for vaccines, which has been extensively researched in an unbiased manner, is causing, quote, health declines in vulnerable children, which what does that even mean? I don't know. But she's questioning the vaccine schedule, which is a safe, effective public health policy.
And this puts her in line with so many of these other nominees from Trump's administration that questioned vaccines, that sow public doubt. And now we're in a place where over 1,000 people in this country have had measles in 2025. That outbreak is continuing to grow. People are continuing to get sick and dying from measles, a vaccine preventable illness that was previously eradicated in the United States. And we're on track to lose that status as this continues.
And yet, there has been a lot of controversy about her nomination, including people from the Make America Healthy Again campaign, specifically saying her views on vaccines are not in line with that of the MAHA.
There's a lot of criticism of her from within MAHA and from outside MAHA. So let's start with that.
So from within the MAHA supporters, they're calling her a, quote, Marxist tree hugger. They're questioning her alignment with the party. And it's over the concern that she's not strict enough against vaccines, and that the big concern is that she's never pushed for the COVID vaccine to be pulled from the market.
So her goal overall is to question vaccine safety, but from within the MAHA movement, she's not vocal enough about this. So they're saying that she's not anti-vaccine enough.
So fascinating. And this is just like mind-blowing to me, because she has expressed a lot of skepticism over the childhood vaccine schedule. She's expressed a lot of skepticism over the hepatitis B vaccine given to newborns. And yet this is not enough.
And this is the bias that we see in this administration, is that they're choosing people whose views align with their own and not with evidence or science. And it is just concerning as we think about America's health moving forward.
MAHA supporters have actually been citing her limited medical experience, her limited public health experience, and her medical credentials. And this is a concern that's not just limited to MAHA supporters.
There are people who are very supportive of this current administration who are critical of her for not having an active medical license, including Laura Loomer, who said on social media, and this is a quote, "So basically, the new Surgeon General is a total crackpot, a shroom consumer, and she talks to trees and doesn't even have an active medical license." While at the same time, there are people who are very critical of this administration who are also critical of Casey Means for not having an active medical license. For example, Dr. Jerome Adams, an anesthesiologist who served as Surgeon General during President Trump's first term and has been critical of Trump's policies around healthcare, is also tweeting about this and says on X, "I can only speak for me, but I was a licensed and practicing physician with a master's degree in public health and had previously run the Indiana State Department of Health for 4 years. So really commenting on the historical, legal, and practical qualifications of this role for Surgeon General.
And yet RFK Jr. has responded on X, quote, "Casey is the perfect choice for Surgeon General precisely because she has left the traditional medical system, not in spite of it." And similarly, one of the White House spokespersons, Kush Desai, has said, quote, "Dr. Casey Means has the ideal balance of elite credentials without the baggage of being beholden to the corrupt healthcare system that has profited from America's chronic disease epidemic."
It is so concerning to me that RFK Jr. is saying she's qualified because she's left traditional medicine. And that in one statement really is trying to discredit all practicing and licensed physicians in America.
The use of the word baggage, the baggage of being beholden to the healthcare system, like that makes me a worse physician to understand the healthcare system, to have worked in the system, to understand, like, there are many problems with our healthcare system, but the baggage of that knowledge makes me worse at leading the public health system. Like, that is alarming.
And meanwhile, she's the one who's profiting from advertising these non-evidence-based creams and teas on social media. And we, that as physicians are recommending evidence-based treatments to our patients and their families to help keep them healthy, we who are trying to devise, test, study new treatments to help people achieve their life goals, instead of selling teas on social media, we're the ones who have baggage. So it'll be interesting to see her Senate confirmation hearings.
If she makes it there.
That's true. The first nominee did not make it to the Senate confirmation hearings.
Also over COVID vaccines.
So we will see what happens here. RFK Jr.'s former running mate, Nicole Shanahan, had something to say about this. Also on social media saying, "Yes, it's very strange. Doesn't make any sense." And then she had more to say after that. But I think those are some good words to leave on.
You know, she and I don't agree on a lot.
But I think it's nice to close on. Yes, it's very strange. Doesn't make any sense.
That has been the theme of a lot of health policy in this new administration. Not only the nomination of Dr. Casey Means, but also every episode that we've done. Doesn't make very much sense.
We might need a new theme song. Yes, it's very strange. Doesn't make any sense. We'll work with our audio engineer to get that. Rolling forward, doctor, sister, son. And with that, this is the Rowland Forward Podcast.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
Be sure to subscribe, reach out on our social medias. We're on X, Blue Sky, TikTok.
And we'd love to hear from you.
And you can always reach out by email. Our email is rowlinforwardshow. That's rowlinforwardshow@gmail.com.
And we'll see you next week. We'll be back for more fun or very strange health news.
That doesn't make any sense.
I was working essentially 12-hour overnights back to back, which is a little bit less fun than a conference in Hawaii. How was it?
I was doing very rigorous conference attending.